All I can tell you is that these numbers are more than incredibly aggressive. Eisner frowned, then seemed resigned. He stood up. I hear what you're saying. I don't envy you, he said. You have a really bad job. Then he walked out. Early in the summer of 2002, Pixar's Steve Jobs invited Disney's Thomas Schumacher to visit Pixar's new animation facility in Emeryville, just outside of San Francisco, which featured a badminton court in the lobby. Jobs and Lasseter were obviously proud of their new creation. At the end of the tour, Lasseter said, I'll see you guys back at the studio, and walked toward his car. I'll give you a ride back, Jobs told Schumacher. It was obvious he wanted a chance to speak to him alone. The relationship with Disney is going so well, Jobs began, ticking off the amazing string of successes. Toy Story, Toy Story 2, A Bug's Life, and the previous year's Monsters, Incorporated. I love you, Jobs continued, but I'm furious with Michael. He reminded him of Eisner's stubbornness over the sequels to Toy Story, and again brought up Eisner's testimony in Congress. How can I be a partner with someone like that? Jobs asked. I don't trust Michael. I don't know who I can trust. It was an awkward half-hour ride, since there wasn't much Schumacher could say without seeming disloyal to Eisner. When he returned to Disney headquarters, Schumacher sought out Eisner. Michael, let me tell you, they're really pissed off. Eisner brushed aside his concerns. They'll get over it. Steve Jobs and I will take a walk. Schumacher wasn't the only Disney person to whom Jobs reached out that summer. One day, Roy Disney bumped into Dick Cook, chairman of the studio, in the parking lot. Jobs had refused to negotiate directly with Eisner, so Cook was acting as intermediary. Steve Jobs would love to talk to you, Cook reported, but he doesn't want to call you directly. So Roy called Jobs. As he had to Schumacher, Jobs aired a long list of grievances against Eisner. He'll say one thing one day, another the next, and then he'll deny saying it at all, Jobs complained. Roy had heard much the same thing from Lasseter. I just don't see how the relationship can continue as long as Eisner is there, Jobs concluded. Roy empathized with Jobs, and the next time he was in San Francisco, he had dinner at Jobs's home in Palo Alto. Roy had an Eisner story of his own to match every one that Jobs told. He shared his observation that when Eisner and Welles came to Disney in 1984, it had been like the scene in The Wizard of Oz where the Munchkins are freed from the Wicked Witch of the East and sing, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead. Now Eisner had become the witch. Jobs nodded in agreement. I'll never make a deal as long as Eisner is there. When he returned to Los Angeles, Roy briefed Gold on the dinner and said he was gravely worried about the Pixar relationship. Though they didn't want to reveal that Roy had met with Jobs, they began interjecting concerns about the Pixar negotiations into their periodic letters to the board. But it didn't seem to do any good. Later that summer, Shapiro convened a retreat at the Grand Californian Hotel at Disneyland to forge an identity and a new brand for the Family Channel. Now that repurposing had been discredited as an overall programming strategy and Bornstein was gone, the staff felt liberated. Using reams of market research, they examined the landscape of cable channels to